Let's take your car into Amusement Parks USA. At Palisades and South Marine Parks, the roller coasters are flying. At Euclid Beach on the flying turns, I'll bet you can't keep from smiling.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Over the past few days, we've celebrated the start of summer by talking about where you can find the best ice cream in Southern California. Yesterday, it was offbeat or eccentric museums where you shared with us your favorites. Today, we talk about the history of the amusement park. Now, we all know the central role of Walt Disney's Disneyland and Walter Knott's Knott's Berry Farm on the creation of the more modern-day theme park. But well before that, we had amusement attractions like piers up and down the coast. We had alligator farms, ostrich racing attractions. We had all kinds of places that Angelenos would go to in search of entertainment. And with me is the author of the brand new book, The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills, and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them, Stephen M. Silverman. Stephen, good to have you with us today.
This is as thrilling as being at an amusement park.
Oh, thank you. I just love your book. You go back to the early European amusement parks and even the role of royalty in creating these attractions. But I do want to focus on California because we have so many attractions here in the state that have been influential elsewhere. It's not just Coney Island that's had an effect on it. So what are some of the earliest here in Southern California?
Well, and of all places, in the we're talking the 1880s. You know, this was a vast wasteland at that point. But there was a fellow from South Africa, Charles Sketchley, who started importing ostriches, really to pluck them to sell the feathers for fashion. They fetched a high price. Well, he opened a farm which he had financed by Henry Gaylord Wilshire, whose name may be familiar. Of all places, I mean, talk about karmic, it was on the border of what became Buena Park in Anaheim. This is the 1880s. And it was really strictly a farm, but people came from far and wide because they'd heard of these unusual creatures, you know, milling about and laying eggs and being plucked. And it struck him, if I charge people to see this, I'll make money. Key to any of these parks was he opened a souvenir stand.
Of course. Gotta have your merchandise.
But then started the tourist influx into Los Angeles, which was a result of the Santa Fe and Union Pacific Railroads having price wars. Well, Buena Park and Anaheim weren't that convenient to those who came in to Union.
Right.
So he got Griffith J. Griffith to finance a move into Los Angeles, and that's where the Los Angeles Ostrich Farm was.
Right on the border of Highland Park and South Pasadena.
Right. Well, but then by that time, because of what he had accomplished in Buena Park and Anaheim, there were ostrich farms all over Southern California. So his quickly went out of commission. Griffith gave the city the land. That became Griffith Park.
So that was another one.
Clausen's in South Pasadena. They were all over. But what became sort of the central area in Los Angeles was, it's now called Lincoln Park. I grew up in Los Angeles. I live in New York now. But I must admit, I don't really know where Lincoln Park is. But that became the center of first the ostrich farm. An ostrich farm remained there. An alligator farm. William Selig was a film producer. He started in Chicago. He came out here for the abundant sunshine, but also to escape the Edison Trust. And his studio was in Silver Lake. But he opened the Selig Zoo, and he shot jungle epics. The first Tarzan movie with Elmo Lincoln was shot in Lincoln Park at the Selig Zoo. He sold his studio in Silver Lake to William Fox, and not only expanded his studio at Lincoln Park, but he had plans to build an entire, and for lack of a better expression, Coney Island. And it was going to have all the rides. The Chute de Chute, which was the first key ride, even before the roller coaster came in. It never happened. And then Selig lost his main star, Tom Mix. So the whole thing got lost. But it then went through several owners. And there was an amusement park built there. It was Chutes Park with, again, the Chute de Chutes. And that was never properly cultivated or policed. It became part of a franchise of Luna Parks, which were all over the world. They were copied from the Coney Island Luna Park, which had opened in 1897. But that franchise, there's still two Luna Parks in the world back from that era, and that's in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia. But that one also went belly up.
We're talking with the author of The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. If you're someone who went to one of these older attractions in Southern California, you remember the Deer Park in Anaheim that was around for a while, trying to take advantage of Disneyland's growth since, families are coming there anyway. There was the Hollywood Wax Museum, 866, or Movieland Wax Museum, 866-893. KPECC 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk about the piers because that's a big part. Abbot Kinney with Venice.
They were actually, believe it or not, developed later. Downtown Los Angeles was developed first. Nobody thought to go to the beach. The first pier was Long Beach. And in fact, it's the first pier in the state of California.
Was that the Pine Avenue Pier?
It became known as the Pike. And it was around until 1968, but it really wasn't a very savory place ever, to be perfectly honest. But the Abbot Kinney in 1905, he was a tobacco heir from New York. He'd been all over the world. He wanted to build Venice of America on the canals. He got the marshland of Venice. He got the worst land in Venice because he thought, I can easily dig canals. And not only were there homes for sale there, but there was a pleasure pier, as they called them. And he had the latest rides, all the latest and greatest. LaMarcus Thompson was known as the father of the gravity ride. He introduced the roller coaster in America. It originally started in Russia. It moved to the French, put wheels on it, so really making it a roller coaster. But it sort of stayed in Europe, and he developed the notion of a switchback railroad from an old mine train. And he then developed what they called scenic railways, which were dark rides combined with roller coasters. Sort of think of the Matterhorn at Disneyland. But these were really elaborate structures.
Yeah. Or Space Mountain is one of those dark coasters.
Yeah, but you know, these would stop so you would see. He actually had people from Broadway design the tableaus. And they were marvelous. And, they would light up. And they would be air cooled if you would pass something that looked like Switzerland. They were all very imaginative. There was a great one at Venice Pier. It was eventually replaced by the Golden Age of the roller coaster because Henry Ford had put everyone behind the wheel of a car. Once Americans had their own cars to drive and they could provide themselves with their own thrills, amusement park owners had to provide super thrills. So that's how the roller coaster really came into its own.
We'll continue our conversation with the author of The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills, and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them, Stephen M. Silverman, and Greater Los Angeles, with plenty in this book, its influential place, with the pleasure piers up and down Southern California, the attractions that built up in advance of Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm, and of course, the first movie studio to come up with the idea of a tourist attraction was our own Universal. We'll talk about that and more at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. Stephen Silverman with us on AirTalk, and he's just sharing with me this book, which, this is a heavy tome, The Amusement Park, which is an extraordinary history of centuries of development of attractions that he wrote it actually in less than a year because he was so immersed in it. He lived, ate, breathed the subject matter. And it's astounding how fast he was able to do this once you've seen the book. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Brian in West Hollywood says, I lived in Coney Island in the 60s when I was under the age of 12. Wonderful place for summer and weekends and lots of tourists. Very vibrant and, boy, crowded on weekends. That's Brian in West Hollywood. And in Pasadena, I understand your great-grandfather had some connection back to the amusement park at Lincoln Park?
Well, not to the amusement park. He got a city concession in 1906 when they had put in the lake, and he ran the boats there. My grandfather, his son, worked one 4th of July and made $40 selling peanuts. Excuse me. And so he went home and told his dad he made a fortune in one day, so they bought the concession. And the family was in the business till the mid-60s.
He made 40 bucks in a day in 1906?
$50 on the 4th of July. It was as much
month,
I know. And so they bought the concession, and they had the Lincoln Park, Echo Park, MacArthur Park, and Hollenbeck Park, and Reseda later on when they put in the lake there. And they it was just a wonderful place, and my grandfather developed the mahogany boats, the motor boats. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah, I do.
And I didn't realize the same person had all those.
Yeah.
go ahead, Stephen.
No. I remember fondly. I was but a small child, very small.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ann. I appreciate you sharing about your family's involvement in that. 866-893-KPECC. The piers you were mentioning, the Pike in Long Beach, which later became the New Pike.
Right after the war.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to improve its reputation.
That's how they advertised it when I was a kid, was
exactly.
to New Pike.
And you, Pike.
Tried to make it family friendly, but it still had the sort of tattoo parlor, bars.
Sailors and hookers.
Yeah, that was the reputation of it. But it was interesting how piers, you know, would try and distinguish themselves. I think it was Lick Pier
that had
the big ballroom and Lawrence Welk.
Right,
and
the Aragon Ballroom.
Yeah, yeah. So they were trying to set themselves apart from the more tawdry image.
And then when Disneyland was so successful, that opened in 1955, the next year, Charles Straub and the producer, Hal Roach, who produced Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang, they own the L.A. Turf Club, which owns Santa Anita. Roy Disney, Walt's brother, went to ABC's Leonard Goldenson, got the money for Disneyland. They went to William Paley at CBS and got the money to buy Ocean Park Pier and redo it. And they, in 1958, it opened as Pacific Ocean Park, which for someone my age is still one of the holy grails.
I actually preferred that to going to Disneyland, crazy as that sounds.
I know.
There was something kind of spooky about POP.
It smelled good, for one thing. You're at the beach, and it looked like the space age. But it was really the poor man's Disneyland. There's no doubt about it. And it never made money.
Yeah,
never.
It went bankrupt pretty quickly.
In 67, it closed.
And eventually burned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's still the pilings there with their signs on the beach warning you about the pilings for boats or if you're going into the water. If you remember some of these early attractions of Southern California, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Now, what convinced the owners of Universal Studios that people would want to come visit a studio and tour the lot?
It happened first. It was in two stages. From the very beginning, when the studio opened in 1915, there were the Gray Line tours. And they would come, and for 25 cents, you could go in and see a movie being shot and get a chicken lunch. but then when the sound came in, the tourists made too much noise, so they killed off the tourists. That was the end of it. Well, Lou Wasserman in the 60s saw how much money Walt Disney was making at Disneyland and thought maybe it's time to bring back the pier and the tour. And originally they aligned with Gray Line, and they thought, why should we do that? We can keep all the money. And they actually hired a Disney artist to come up with a welcoming pavilion and what they called glamour trams to take you through the sound stages. And very quickly they were earning profits of $1 million a year from the tour. But you would only stay on the lot so long, and then the tourists would end up going to Disneyland. So they said, well, why don't we add a stunt show? Why don't we maybe add a ride? Then came Steven Spielberg. Why don't we add a shark? Why don't we add dinosaurs?
King Kong.
Yes, right. And you now have a real rival to Disney with Harry Potter at the Universal Parks.
And, of course, they had the amphitheater for many years with concerts all
right.
summer long. And then once right. they put the roof on it all year long,
right.
Which gave way for the Harry Potter.
They got rid of the arena.
Yeah. Oh, Lisa wants to talk about one of my boyhood favorites. Lisa in Rancho Palos Verdes. Go right ahead.
Yeah, there used to be a small amusement park on Beverly Boulevard where Cedars-Sinai Hospital is now.
Beverly Park and the pony rides next door.
Right. Actually, and it's the Beverly Center is there now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And the owner consulted with Walt Disney, went to Europe, and came back and gave Walt some ideas for Disneyland.
Lisa, do you remember the little roller coaster that they had at Beverly Park? It was the scale of it. It was almost laughable now, but as a kid, I thought it was the coolest thing.
Oh, I loved it. I loved that park so much. It was so much fun to go to.
And what was nice, too, is you could do kids' birthday parties there, and it was much more affordable, you know, for working-class families like mine who, you know, going to Disneyland was just not something we could really afford. But Beverly Park was affordable.
And it was so close to Beverly Hills that all the divorced fathers, it's where they would take their kids on weekends.
Right. Hey, Paul in Glendale, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, I was just telling the producer that when I was a kid in the 50s, my dad would take me to Disneyland every before Christmas, because before Christmas you could actually get on rides back then. But we took a helicopter from the Sepulveda Dam down to Disneyland. There was a service, an old Army air helicopter with open doors that you could take down there, and we did that three times.
Wow.
It ended when there was a crash, and that was the end of the helicopter
service.
There was a crash.
There was no guards on it at all. So we just watched all those swimming pools go by underneath us.
Oh, my goodness. What a thrill ride before you'd even get to Disneyland. Paul, thank you. Appreciate your sharing that. Fluton wants to bring up Pacific Ocean Park. You bet. P.O.P.
Pay one price.
Yeah, yeah. Yvonne wondering when those ostrich farms went away. What killed off the ostrich farms?
Lack of interest. The alligator farm held on in Lincoln Park until the 50s. It moved right across the street from Knott's Berry Farm, which we haven't even talked about.
That was there in the 60s. And, of course, what Walter and Cordelia Knott did with Knott's Berry Farm, their restaurant, which is still there.
Yes.
And the Old West feel of it, which, of course, now it's much more of a Magic Mountain-like kind of ride-centric experience. Stephen, thanks so much.
Larry,
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Stephen M. Silverman, The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills, and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. Much more to come in our second hour. I'll tell you about it momentarily.